Scott, let's get started with the conflict between Hezbollah and Israel. Israelis are talking about that their preemptive attack was successful. On the other hand, Hezbollah is saying that they have achieved nothing. What do we know from what's going on between them?
Well, we have two competing narratives. One is that Israel carried out this massive retaliation strike, making use of the most advanced military capabilities in their arsenal, F-35 fighters, 100 aircraft, targeting a number of sites preemptively. We also know that Hezbollah retaliated using low technology equipment that appeared to saturate and carve a hole or a gap in the Israeli air defense, which was then exploited by drones, which carried out a very successful attack against one of the most sensitive intelligence sites in all of Israel, Unit 8200. They're the, basically the equivalent of the National Security Agency of the United States. Hezbollah has said that the Israelis hit nothing. We don't know. We don't know what the battle damage assessment is. What we do know is that both sides have toned down the rhetoric at this point in time, and that it looks like the emphasis is being shifted back to Gaza for the time being. I think this is just part of the managed escalation. I think, though, if the Israeli preemption was successful, Hezbollah still demonstrated that it didn't preempt anything, that Hezbollah was able to penetrate Israel's air defense and launch a successful strike using very low technology weapons. But if the Israeli intervention was not successful, as Hezbollah is telling the truth, Israel has actually given away a lot of information. First of all, this was a major military operation, 100 aircraft. F-35s refueling. It involves targeting, and we're talking about immediate targeting because this is a preemptive strike. So Israel's saying that they are detecting things as it's happening to try and prevent an imminent threat. I don't know what Hezbollah's intelligence capabilities are. I can tell you that if I were a Hezbollah intelligence officer, based upon what Israel did, I would be able to reconstruct or deconstruct the Israeli actions and identify the various nodes of criticality when it comes to preventing Israel from doing this again. Israel gave away a lot doing this attack, and I believe if Hezbollah is right, accomplished little or nothing. Hezbollah claims that it didn't stop any of the rockets that were intended to be fired. They were all Katyusha rockets, very low sophistication. Israel did manage to destroy some of the launchers after they had launched their rockets, but none of Hezbollah's advanced capabilities were affected by this. So Israel gave away the farm and accomplished very little. So advantage Hezbollah, I would say right now, but neither side wants to see this thing escalate out of control, and so I think right now we have a lull in the escalation. But until they get a ceasefire agreement, until this Gaza conflict is brought to an end, the conflict between Israel and Hezbollah will continue to go through this cycle of escalation management.
Did Hezbollah use its ballistic missiles? If not, why they didn't use it?
They didn't use them because they're not ready to escalate to that level. When Hezbollah unveils its ballistic missiles, they will be striking the heart of Tel Aviv. They will be striking central Israel. They will be striking the most sensitive targets in Israel. And this is the kind of escalation that Israel can't allow to de-escalate. This now means decisive full-scale engagement between Hezbollah and Israel. So these weapons are held in reserve by Hezbollah until which time they need to be used. Right now, Hezbollah didn't need to send that signal. They sent a different signal, which is you killed one of our people, were trying to kill one of yours. And the rumor is that they were going after the head of Unit A200. Whether or not they were successful in this, there's some reports that say they were, there's some reports that say they weren't. But, you know, it was clearly an effort by Hezbollah to kill a very senior Israeli military official. And that's the kind of retaliation that prevents escalation, meaning that it is reciprocal in nature, as opposed to being, you know, totally disproportional to what Israel had done to Hezbollah.
There is an interview with a 77 years old Israeli general with Hearts. He's talking about how important is this war of attrition for Israel, and they're not capable of having this type of war, a conventional war, a war of attrition with Hezbollah or Iran. And do you think, is there anybody in the Netanyahu administration taking this type of mindset serious?
Well, I mean, first of all, Israel's never prepared for anything like this. Such a long conflict has not been part of Israel's operational or strategic planning. I've been saying this for some time, that Israel lacks the capacity to continue this indefinitely. They will exhaust themselves militarily, they will exhaust themselves economically, and eventually they will exhaust themselves from a socio-political standpoint, as Israelis with dual citizenship, with that second passport, start to flee the country because Israel is no longer a country that's livable, at least not to the lifestyle that the Israelis had hoped for by moving there. Netanyahu is in the fight of his political life. This is the final battle. This is about his legacy. And so a lot of what Netanyahu does isn't about the legitimate national security interests of Israel or what's best for the Israeli people, but it's all about what's best for Benjamin Netanyahu. To retain political viability up until the very end, to ensure that when he does step out of the political arena for the last time, that it is as somebody who is victorious, somebody who is seen as fulfilling his mandate of securing Israel. It's very difficult to do under these circumstances. He, of course, is the man who helped drive a decisive wedge amongst the Israeli population because of his efforts to politicize the Israeli judiciary. This is before October 6th, when he was seeking changes in the basic law of Israel that would allow the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, to control judicial appointments and to question judicial decisions. This was done for very selfish reasons, because Netanyahu, of course, has ongoing corruption cases. If he is ever hauled before an Israeli court on these charges, he will probably be found guilty and sent away for the rest of his life. Or, even if he's not imprisoned, it'll be the end of his career, and then the last thing he'll be known as is being, convicted of corruption. He wants to be known as the man who saved Israel, is one of Israel's greatest leaders, etc. But he's also the man who was at the helm on October 7th when Hamas launched its surprise attack. He's also now the man who has been at the helm for the longest war Israel's ever fought, and it's a war that Israel's not winning. And so he is desperate to find some sort of political solution to this problem. Every decision that's made, I believe, is couched in terms of how does this benefit Benjamin Netanyahu, not in terms of how does this benefit the Israeli people and Israeli security.
And we've seen something similar to what we've seen before when we had a Iranian attack on Israel. We didn't see a lot of pictures coming out of Israel. Right now, they've banned anything, taking pictures, videos, sending out. And if this attack that Hezbollah did on Israel was not successful, what, they're not letting people take pictures, reporting if something happened? It seems that they were successful in their attack.
I don't know. I'm a guy with experience in what we call battle damage assessment. And one of the things we do when we launch attacks is we want to get imagery of the results so that we can determine whether or not we accomplished what it was we were seeking to accomplish. Do we have to strike again? If we failed, why did we fail? There's a lot of intelligence that's in that. Why would Israel want to provide battle damage assessment to Hezbollah? Even if Hezbollah failed, there's invaluable information to be gained by looking at imagery. Why didn't we hit that? Was this about targeting, or was there a defense capability that we weren't aware of? Things of that nature. So no, under no circumstance should Israel allow anybody to film anything. They're in an active war right now with Hezbollah. Any imagery is useful to Hezbollah, especially post-strike imagery that talks about the success or failure of the attack. So, I understand the public's desire to know, but in the case of something like this, there is no need to know on the part of the public, because by releasing the information to the public, you're releasing it to Hezbollah, and Hezbollah will be able to gain some intelligence value from this. So I don't know, Hezbollah also, I would imagine has its own post-strike reconnaissance capability. At some point in time, Hezbollah may fly a drone over that area. From their perspective, hopefully sooner rather than later. You get the best BDA the closer you are to the event. And then they can release the images. But it's not Israel's job to do Hezbollah's work. There's no requirement for Israel to release imagery that either contradicts or proves what Hezbollah says happened.
It seems that we are two different type of ideas within the Netanyahu or inside Israel. Even within the Netanyahu administration, we have the point of view of his Ministry of Defense and his type and the people who are more in their mindset, more are closer to what Netanyahu thinks at the moment. Do you think that who has the upper hand right now in Israel? Is Golan capable of winning over Netanyahu in the long run?
Well, first of all, I'll say that my experience in Israel, and it was extensive, the idea that there's only two points of view is ludicrous. I remember once sitting down at a table early on with senior defense officials and foreign ministry officials. There were maybe a dozen people around the table. And we were talking about issues that one would have thought Israel would have been unified on. There were 12 different points of view, 12 different points of view. Nobody agrees on anything. Everybody believes they have the right. And they were all 12 points of view were, soundly defended, articulated. The oftentimes the differences are in nuances and then, on the periphery. But the idea that within the Israeli cabinet, there's Gallant and then there's Netanyahu is absurd. Even within Gallant's staff, there will be people who have different points of view and they will articulate this. Surrounding Netanyahu will be people with different points of view. So the idea that this is a black and white case, it's Gallant's way or Netanyahu's way, it doesn't work that way. Both sides will be working the issue from the periphery, meaning that they will be seeking to take people. You'll try to divide it. This is now we get into shades of gray. If Netanyahu is dark gray, those people whose opinions closely resemble Netanyahu will be hanging around Netanyahu. Light gray is Gallant. Those people are hanging around there. And then what Gallant and Netanyahu are trying to do is poach these people off to sit there and say, I need to get some of these dark gray guys to lighten up and come over here and bring things. So it's a very complicated process. A lot of discussion. And it's not about Gallant winning over Netanyahu. That isn't going to happen. It's about Gallant winning over enough people who currently surround Netanyahu so that the totality of the opposition can put pressure on Netanyahu. This is about politics, Israeli politics, and it's very complicated. In America, we got Republican and Democrat, with a couple of independents out there, but mainly Republican and Democrat. In Israel, you have many political parties, and then within the political parties, you have factions This coalition that Netanyahu has cobbled together is a very weak coalition, hinges on Netanyahu doing exactly what the minority members want, because he can't afford to lose any member of this coalition. And so that faction that has, you know, only one or two seats, Netanyahu can't lose them. So that faction now can start making demands of Netanyahu that Netanyahu has to pay attention to, because if they walk away, he's out of government. And so what's happening here is a much more complicated internal dialogue taking place within Israel than maybe people in the West understand.
Again, getting back to the points that this Israeli general was mentioning, that he said that Israel is not prepared to go after a war of attrition. The situation of the Israeli army is not that good right now. And because of the suffering that they have experienced in this conflict in Gaza. And on the other hand, the outcome would be the continuation of this conflict, the way that they have been carrying out all more than 11 months, 10 months that they're doing this. And he says that it's not in favor of Israel to continue this way.
Well, he's right. I mean, literally, Israel is failing. Israel has lost. I have said repeatedly, I think the die has been cast. Israel cannot recover from this conflict. Economically, the Israeli economy is in tatters, and it's not going to rebuild. One of the key dialogues that's taking place on the side is the United States is trying to get Saudi Arabia to reconcile its differences with Israel, to recognize Israel, to enter into diplomatic relations with Israel. And the concept that empowers this is the notion that Israel will serve as the economic hub, sort of the engine, the technology-driven engine of whatever partnership can be crafted. You know, Saudi money with Israeli know-how creates this, you know, team that can dominate the region and have a major impact on the world. But Israel will never again rest in peace. It's over. Gaza has proven that. Until there's a Palestinian state, Israel will never rest in peace. And if Israel's not resting in peace, then their economy can't recover. And their economy right now is devastated, gutted, billions of dollars of losses. The Israeli society is deeply fractured now. There will be people who say, we have to accept a new reality if we want to survive. There will be others who say we must double down and create a greater Israel and eliminate this Palestinian scourge once and for all. Israel will never again be united on the direction it needs to go. There will always be this debate. And I think right now, because of the pressure being placed on Israel from around the world, there will be a discussion that leads to the creation of a Palestinian state. And as soon as you have that happen, some important changes have to take place inside of Israel, some of which Israel will never recover from. And one of these is the disenfranchisement of these Brooklyn Jews, I call them, these American Jews who have flown over to Israel to steal land in the West Bank, to murder Palestinians, to create these illegal settlements. These settlements will have to be dismantled. This will cause huge domestic problems, maybe even take Israel up to the brink of civil war. And basically, all of these factors are creating an Israel that is not a safe place to live, is not a good place to live, not a good place to raise children. And I think you're going to see millions of Israelis who have dual citizenship flee Israel. And now you have a demographic problem. Right now, 9 million Jews, roughly a little bit more than that in terms of non-Jews, Arabs, Muslims, and Christians. But when you start dropping that population, when the number of Jews starts dropping down to 7 million, to 6 million, to 5 million, suddenly Israel stops being viable in terms of its current makeup. And the concept of a two-state solution yields to the reality of a single-state solution. I think that's the direction that we're headed. And I don't think there's anything Israel can do to stop this. Now, the question is, does Israel want to do this in a way that minimizes damage to whatever Jewish entity remains in the Holy Land? Or do they want to do something that leads to the total destruction of Israel? If Netanyahu and his ilk have this way, they'll lead to the total destruction of what we today call Israel. If saner minds come in and start working diplomatically, I do believe that we can work our way towards a single Palestinian state where Jews, Muslims, Christians can live together in peace and harmony. But it's going to be called Palestine, not Israel. It's not going to be a Jewish state. It's going to be a state dominated by Muslims, but hopefully a Muslim state that respects the Jewish faith, respects the Holy Land and the Jewish role in the Holy Land, along with the Christian role in the Holy Land. In some way they can all get, is this pie in the sky stuff? Right now it seems like it, but that's the vector, I think. That's the direction that this is headed. This notion of somehow Israel emerging from this stronger, more unified, part of a broader coalition of, Arab nations is fantasy. That's what the Abrams Accord was about. Hamas's attack on October 7th sunk that ship.
One of the points that Nasrallah was talking about in his speech was that they were waiting to see if something happens with that with those negotiations between Israelis and Gazans. Do you think they're still hoping for have a political settlement between Israelis and Gazans?
I mean, there will have to be a political settlement because Israel can't survive if this war continues. You've had repeated Israeli generals retired say that, in a year's time, Israel will collapse of its own, on its own volition, because it can't continue this fight. So eventually Hamas will not be defeated. I mean, we have another Israeli general that has admitted that Hamas is not just a physical entity, but it's a political point of view. It's an ideology. And you can't defeat that militarily. In fact, the more Israel commits genocide, the stronger Hamas gets from an ideological standpoint. So the reality is Israel is going to have to deal with Gaza on the terms set by the Gazans. And right now, the leadership of the Gazans is Hamas. There are things being done to try and make such a dialogue possible, which is, for instance, China brought together 14 different Palestinian factions to create some sort of singularity that's inclusive of Hamas and Fatah, so that when Israel is ready for meaningful discussions, that which sits across from it isn't going to be called Hamas. And that might be a political compromise that has to be made in order to get not only Israel to the table, but to get Fatah, the Palestinian the PLA, Palestinian Authority, Palestinian Liberation Organization, get them to the table as well, because there are factions within the Palestinian community that are not supportive of Hamas, that are deeply resentful of Hamas and would not participate in any large-scale discussions or dialogue with Hamas representing them all. So what China did, and again, Russia played an important role in helping facilitate this, China is at least in the moving in the direction of creating a governance entity that Hamas factors in, but it's not called Hamas. And at some point in time, Israel will have no choice but to sit down at a table across from them. We'll be sitting somebody from this entity. That's the only way this ends. This doesn't end in an Israeli victory. That's for sure.
If you were Chinese, how do you feel about the attitude of the United States when it comes to Gaza? Because they were trying to bring these groups together. But we see that the United States attitude is totally different. They're trying to help Israel in whatever they want to do in Gaza. Do you think that they're feeling that the United States is helping these negotiations or something else?
I don't think there's anybody in the world, including Americans, if they can speak off camera, who believes that America is facilitating in a positive way negotiations. We have betrayed ourselves by siding so strongly with Israel. And in fact, the irony is by siding so strongly with Israel, we've actually done Israel a great disservice. because we would have been better positioned had we retained a modicum of independence where we could be trusted as a broker. And then we could, you know, help babysit a peace process that maybe gave Israel more of what they're looking for. But today, nobody trusts us. And one of the reasons is all we bring is death and destruction. Our only solution is more war, more weapons, more confrontation. I mean, China comes in and their solution has nothing to do with war. It has to do with facilitating peace, creating opportunities for dialogue, dialogue that leads to, you know, economic political stability that translates into economic stability. So I think there's growing recognition in the Middle East and indeed around the world that if you take American hand of friendship, it's going to lead to a conflict that will probably end up destroying you. I mean, the Ukrainian precedent is there, but so is the Kurdish precedent. So is the Afghan precedent. You know, the United States hasn't hit one out of the ballpark in terms of, you know, a conflict that promotes its geopolitical position in a long, long time. And we're not going to. The world is tired of war. The world is exhausted of war. The world is looking for peaceful outcomes. And, you know, the United States therefore becomes part of the problem, not part of the solution, because all we know is war.
How do you find Iran right now? Do you think they're going to attack Israel within 72 hours, as Washington is pointing out?
Iran has every right to attack Israel anytime it wants to, given what Israel did in terms of assassinating a senior Hamas official in Tehran. But Iran has to look out for Iran's best interest. And Iran also has to keep an eye on the bubble. If Iran is part of a resistance that's dedicated to supporting the notion of the creation of a Palestinian state, understand that they're winning. Right now, they're winning. We just had a long discussion about how difficult of a situation Israel's in. And one of the reasons why there won't be stability down the road is because of the role Iran plays in facilitating the efforts of the axis of resistance to keep Israel destabilized. The Houthi, Iranian militias, Syrian militias, Hezbollah, Hamas. So if Iran were to decisively engage, it changes the whole dynamic of this conflict from one where the axis of resistance, the Palestinians, are winning. It's a difficult fight. When I say winning, that doesn't imply they're ready to have a parade down Main Street. But, it's ugly. The genocide is real. The death of these Palestinian civilians is real. This is a real struggle. It's not easy, but they're winning because Israel itself acknowledges it can't sustain this indefinitely. It can't even sustain it for another year. So if you're winning, why do you want to change the algorithm of success? And attacking Israel massively could do just that. It could trigger a response from Israel that includes the United States participating, something the United States has been hesitant to do. In fact, has said to Israel, we aren't going to participate in an attack against Iran. But if Iran strikes Israel with such ferocity that it threatens the strategic viability of Israel, the United States may have no choice, both from preserving a geopolitical posture in the region, but also from a political perspective, especially if Iran strikes now in the midst of a presidential election. Biden is saying, well, gosh, if I join in on this attack, I get involved in another Middle Eastern war. Trump has said that that's all I do. Do I want to empower Trump? If I do this, the economy is going to tank. That's going to hurt Harris. And so now American domestic politics factors into this. So, you know, the Iranians are pretty savvy. They're very savvy people. They don't want to do anything that changes the trajectory. And remember, the trajectory isn't just focused on Gaza and creating a Palestinian state. Iran is worried about Iran. I mean, they are going to be a major presence in the upcoming BRICS summit in Kazan, Russia, in October. If there's a major Middle Eastern conflict, nations aren't going to attend. The conference will collapse. All the work that Russia's and Iran and everybody else has been doing to promote BRICS, to position it for success, will be undone. And so I don't see Iran willingly falling into that trap. And again, Netanyahu is constrained. He was able to carry out an assassination in Tehran, but he hasn't been able to carry out a massive attack because Israel lacks the capacity to do so without American help. And at this juncture, America is not inclined to help. And so we have a situation where, you know, again, escalation management comes into play. But Iran doesn't want to. Iran's on a good trajectory right now. A good trajectory. They're leading an axis of resistance that's prevailing against Israel, and they're part of this growing multipolar world that challenges American hegemony, the rules-based international order. They're in a very good position. So I don't see too much pressure being placed on the Iranian government to launch a massive strike against Israel at this time.
Don't you think that they're trying to make the Iranian role in the on October 7, the way that Gazans, Palestinians attack Israel, they're trying to just make it unbelievable, because right now the Trump team is trying to say that the Biden administration sent the money to Iran. That's why Iranians were capable to provide Gazans with weapons and whatever they need. And they were able to attack Israel. Do you think it's part of this 2024 presidential election? It's something domestic, or they're really believing that Iran was behind all of this, and because of the money that the Biden administration sent to Iran, Iran was capable of doing that?
I think this is about domestic American politics. I think this is about exaggerating or manufacturing out of thin air Iranian intent, nefarious Iranian intent, etc. As I said, Iran's not in the business at this point in time of messing with the algorithm of success it currently enjoys. From the Iranian perspective, frankly speaking, it doesn't matter who wins this election. It doesn't. So why would Iran invest resources into trying to control the outcome of this election? Iran, like China, like Russia, has pretty much turned its back on the West. They're no longer concerned about, you know, political nuances. Maybe there's a better chance to get sanctions lifted if so-and-so wins. You know, maybe we can do this, maybe we can do that. They don't care because, frankly speaking, regardless who wins, the policies are going to be bad towards Iran. The Democrats haven't articulated anything that sounds like, oh, we want to improve relations. The Republicans certainly haven't. And so I think the idea of Iran taking such a risk to get involved in a process that it has little chance of altering the outcome, it's absurd. It makes no sense. I don't think Iran is involved because Iran doesn't care. Iran believes that whoever wins is going to be bad for Iran. So therefore, the best thing to do is to solidify your new direction. You know, Iran's no longer pivoted towards the West, hoping for better relations with either the United States or Europe. Iran has pivoted to the East, committed to a Eurasian economic union, a Eurasian security infrastructure, committed to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, committed to BRICS. That's the direction they're headed. So I think almost everything you hear about Iran interfering in the United States is manufactured. It's made up. It's speculative.
The point is that they're thinking that without Iran, Palestinians, Hamas was not capable of doing that offensive on Israelis.
That shows a lot of disrespect for Hamas. I mean, did Iran play a role in arming Hamas? Yeah. There's no doubt in my mind that, you know, many of those weapons were provided by Iran. But Hamas is not incapable of developing its own capabilities. But again, let's just be real. Hamas wouldn't have been able to do October 7th with the resources it had available or sustain this resistance for 10 plus months with resources if Iran wasn't involved in this. Iran has played a very, very big role in this. So, you know, there is legitimacy to that argument that, you know, this couldn't have happened without Iran's involvement. But, you know, but it did happen. And it is the Gazans who are paying the price, which means that this isn't about Iran using Hamas as a tool. This is about Hamas asking for assistance because Hamas knows the direction it wants to go. You know, so I think, you know, that difference, you know, speaks volumes about, you know, the importance of the Iranian thing. Iran didn't invent this crisis. This crisis is because of the Nakba. This crisis is because of irresponsible Israeli policy over the years. This crisis is because of Israel's ongoing brutalization of the Palestinian people. Iran didn't make that up. But Iran is one of the few nations that has said, in fact, it's the only nation that has enshrined in their constitution support for Palestinian statehood. It's amazing that a Shia Persian state would be doing this when Sunni Arab states don't. And I'm talking about Saudi Arabia. I'm talking about the United Arab Emirates. I'm talking about Kuwait. I'm talking about, you know, Qatar. I'm talking about all the nations that, well, Qatar, at least, you know, is there for them. But all the others, they've abandoned. I mean, Yemen's on the side of Gaza now, decisively so, at least the Houthi. But the big players, the guys with the big bucks, with the big resources, who claim to be regional leaders, have shown that they're just sellouts to the West.
And the other perception on the part of Washington, it seems that they're thinking that Iran is behind Houthis, behind Hezbollah, and Iran can control 100% their behavior. Do you think that has anything to the reality of and the nature of the relationship between Iran and these groups?
First of all, the Houthi exist in a historical context that has nothing to do with Iran. In fact, if you want to get down to the particulars of it, going back, the Houthi are practitioners of a version of the Shia faith that many Shia find to be, heretical. I don't want to commit to something. It deals with the numbers of Mahdis or, the emphasis they place on the order of succession from Ali. But the bottom line is they've taken, the succession in a different direction than, the Twelvers or the mainstream Shia faith that is in place in Iran. And there are many in the Iranian Shia community. And Iran is a, heavily religious state governed by a theocracy, who viewed the Houthis as, not being of true faith. So the idea that, they're the loyal servants of Iran is absurd. But from a geopolitical standpoint, Iran has identified with the Houthi cause because it puts, they're pitted against some of Iran's major regional adversaries, Saudi Arabia in particular. So, the Houthi have a very close link with Iran, and their defenses are very much influenced by Iran. But the idea that the Houthi are automatically an extension of Iran and will do whatever Iran dictates, it's more complicated than that. The same thing you can say about Hezbollah. Iran has a relationship with the Shia of Lebanon, especially in the south, Bekaa Valley, south of the Latani River. Where Iranian clerics came in to profess the faith. And so, and then there's intermarriages. And so there's just a family related linkage between the Shia of the South and Iran that then became political when Israel invaded the South. A lot of people don't realize that when Israel went in 1982 and occupied South Lebanon, that the Shia were initially almost supportive of it because they felt that the Palestinian Liberation Organization, and that's the reason why Israel went in, is to purge the PLO, were not acting in their benefit, you know, best interest or Lebanon's best interest. But then the nature of the Israeli occupation was such that the Shia turned against it. And this created, you had the Amal movement, which is a Shia militia, but then the Amal movement fractured, and you started to see the rise of the influence of Shia clergy. Next thing you know, you have this entity created called Hezbollah, which is supported by Iran, not so much officially early on, but because of family. People were coming over because of intermarriages. And then, because this is happening in the midst of not only an Iranian revolution, which is all consuming, but also the Iran-Iraq war. So Iran has a lot of things holding its attention here at home. And it's not like you're saying, oh, and we have so many resources that we can, spin off down to Lebanon. So a lot of what happened because of family relations and things of that nature. But then it gradually grew into Iran providing support for Hezbollah. And there's been very close linkage between the two of them. But again, Hassan Nasrallah doesn't work for Iran. I mean, he, from a theocratic standpoint, yes, he is a believer in Vilayet-i Faqih, the supreme jurisprudence of the supreme leader. And from a religious standpoint, yes, that is true. But what influences Hassan Nasrallah isn't domestic Iranian politics, but domestic Lebanese politics. And so, the idea that he is just an absolute soldier of Iran, will do whatever Iran wants him to do when Iran wants him to do it, is, again, an exaggeration. There's definitely a linkage there. There's definitely influence. But there's a reality, a domestic Lebanese reality, that that has to be factored into everything Hezbollah does today. And that means that Hezbollah is politically independent of Iran. They're allied with, but politically independent of.
Shifting the gear to the conflict in Ukraine, it seems that we have the same kind of issue as we have in Israel between the defense minister and Netanyahu, and in Ukraine between Zelensky and Syrsky. Do we know if Syrsky was agreeing with the concept of offensive on the Kursk region?
Well, I mean, again, when you say do we know, that implies absolute knowledge. And I don't have it. I don't think you have it. I don't think anybody has it. What we can ascertain is that there has been some stress between the office of the presidency and Syrsky on where to place priorities. As was the case with Zeluzhny prior, the man who commanded Ukrainian army prior, Zelensky is very concerned about the politics of this conflict in terms of keeping the money flowing into Ukraine, keeping the weapons flowing into Ukraine. And so he oftentimes seems to be looking for military operations that promote the theory as opposed to the reality of Ukrainian, the viability of Ukraine's continued resistance, etc. And so this is why you got the battle for Bakhmut. This is why you got the 2023 counteroffensive. This is why we got the Battle of Avdiivka. And this is why we got Kursk. Zelensky's looking for the gesture. But every single one of those battles that I described, including Kursk, resulted in a strategic debacle for the Ukrainians, an absolute debacle. And Kursk will end up being a debacle for Ukraine as well. Syrsky is trying to stabilize the front. He is desperately trying to come up with a military solution to the problem of Russian dominance. Right now, Russia is winning the war of attrition. Ukraine is exhausted by this. They can't rotate in new troops. There are no new troops to rotate in. And Syrsky was, I believe, hoping to build up the strategic reserve so that it could be brought down to stabilize the front. There was rumors that that Ukraine was going to be launching some sort of major offensive in the Zaporizhia area using these resources. But I don't think Zelensky was thrilled about repeating 2023 and 2024, meaning sending down your best units and then running up against your Russian defenses that would slaughter you. And so they made a decision. Zelensky talked with advisors, and they came up with an action that was predicated on seizing a nuclear power plant, the cursed nuclear power plant that could be then used to exchange for the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. An important Zelensky goal was to be seen as taking back critical territory from Russia, seizing Kursk and using whatever territory Ukraine could capture in Kursk, again, as leverage to get at least some Ukrainian territory that Russia has annexed to get it returned. And lastly, to put Russia in a very difficult military position where they would have to divert resources away from the Donetsk fighting, where Russia is on a roll right now. Ukrainians are collapsing, to divert resources away from that to deal with the Kursk problem, thereby, salvaging a very bad position the Ukrainians have in the Donbas. That didn't work either. Russia has not diverted meaningful resources. I think Syrsky knew that this Kursk operation wouldn't go well, but he has to obey the orders. That's what civilian control of the military is. And now he's paying a heavy price because, as we speak, the Russians are, very close to some major breakthroughs that'll lead to their occupation of critical terrain features, towns, villages, small cities, etc., that will make it impossible for Ukraine to maintain its position in the Donbas. And there are many people now talking openly about the Ukrainians having to be compelled in the coming weeks to withdraw to the west bank of the Dnieper River because they're not able to maintain their defenses on the west bank.
Can we speculate on the number of forces that Ukrainians have used for this offensive? 12,000, 14,000, something like this?
I think the Russians have said that up to units from, I think it's 18 different units, brigades, battalions, regiments, et cetera, were involved in this. And now we know that the Ukrainians have pulled a couple brigades out of the Kherson and Zaporizhia area to come up and reinforce. They've pulled some units out of the Kharkov front to reinforce. And so I think, now we you're looking at, somewhere between 10 and 20,000 troops being committed to this, but not necessarily in Kursk. In Kursk, the belief is that the maximum number of troops that penetrated were around 10,000. And today they've suffered around 6,000 casualties. Which means they have 4,000 left. They're trying to get reinforcements in, but these brigades that are brought in aren't getting out of the train station oftentimes before the Russians hit them. They're being destroyed in their assembly areas, equipment. And so in the what we'll call the Sumy direction, the Sumy-Kursk direction, there may be between 20 and 30,000 Ukrainian troops, but they're not able to maneuver into the zone because of Russian air power, artillery interdiction, and ground forces now that are increasingly taking control of the battlefield. So I think the number of people who actually crossed into the border was around 10,000, plus or minus a few, and the majority of those have become casualties.
And IAEA Chief Grossi is talking about the risk of nuclear incident in the Kursk region. What's the problem there in your opinion? What's the risk he's talking about?
Yeladonov?
Yeah, IAEA Chief Grossi is talking about there is risk of nuclear incident in the Kursk region.
The Kursk nuclear power plant is an active nuclear power plant. Unlike the Zaporizhia plant, which has been cooled down, if you attack Kursk, if you strike safety infrastructure, you could potentially create the potential for a Chernobyl-type meltdown, which would be catastrophic. So that's what he's talking about. The Russians, though, have the plant very well protected. But, you know, if he's going to make that statement, though, then he has to say that the reason why there's going to be this potential is because of Ukraine and exclusively Ukraine. And he can't say that. He can't acknowledge that it's Ukraine's fault. He's just speaking of a, you know, of the conditions that exist that could lead to the potential of this. And this is part of the strategy of the IAEA and the Europeans in general to create the notion of an emergency that requires European intervention to achieve stability. But it's a narrative that's falling on deaf ears inside Russia. Russia's just not going to allow what? Europe to come in to protect the cursed nuclear power plant. What Russia is going to insist on is that Europe tell Ukraine to leave Kursk and to surrender, that the war is over, that it can't be won. But yeah, that, I think that's it.
And we had Modi's visit to Kiev, and he was talking about the negotiations and peace talks. And today we've learned that he was talking with Putin as well. Do we know what India is trying to do?
And he is trying to be relevant in the world stage. It's a major player. It has some leverage in this conflict because of BRICS. Russia has a long history of relations with India. And so India, you know, operates an independent foreign policy. And so one of the things India would like to do is bring about stability, regional and global stability, by bringing it into this conflict. So, of course, India comes in with, you know, a peace, you know, the concept of the potential of a peace plan. And Russia has always said that it will not close the door on any legitimate discussion about peace. But the door is shut. Modi did visit Kiev, but, Ukraine invaded Kursk, and that changed the entire outcome. Russia is just not in the mood. But Russia is not going to slam the door on Modi. Putin will listen to anything anybody has to say, but then Putin will, you know, inform them of the realities. And that if the peace plan doesn't deal with the realities, then there is no peace plan.
How do you, because the head of Russian intelligence talking about that there is no possibility of having any sort of peace talks with Kiev. And with this attack, do you think that, if you remember those preconditions of Putin before the summit in Switzerland, do you think Russia is achieving those preconditions without having any sort of negotiations?
Absolutely. Demilitarization is taking place as we speak. The Ukrainians are suffering horrific casualties, not only in Kursk, but in the Donbas. They're running out of troops. They're running out of equipment. That is literally the definition of demilitarization. And I think now Russia has made strategic decisions regarding how this conflict ends and what Ukraine looks like when this conflict ends. And I think that the probability of Russia insisting that Odessa become Russia, Mykolaiv becomes Russia, Dnipropetrovsk becomes Russia, Kharkov becomes Russia, and now Sumy becomes Russia, these are real probabilities that will forever change the map of Ukraine and, you know, the relevance of Ukraine going forward. This is the direction we're heading. The day of sitting down and coming up with a modification of the Istanbul communique of April 2022, which is what Putin's plan was in June, those days are finished. Russia's not going to ever do that. When this war ends, Ukraine will be demilitarized, or Ukraine will be denazified. It'll be the end of the Banderist movement, the end of the ultra-Ukrainian nationalist movements, and Ukraine will be neutral. There won't be any NATO forces in Ukraine, and Ukraine will not be entertaining the possibility of joining NATO. I think these are the three things that Putin insists on, and I think these are the realities now that Ukraine has to adapt to if they want to bring this war to an end any other way than unconditional surrender.
But Zelensky says he's not ready to talk about these things, these changes that are happening. And I wonder when he's going to be ready to talk, because Ukraine is losing more and more.
I mean, at some point in time, people just going to have to turn him off. And I think that's the direction people are heading. Nobody cares what he thinks anymore. He's become irrelevant. He can't, you know, move the needle anymore on the geopolitical stage. He isn't the Winston Churchill. He's just a joke. He's a failed comedian. Everybody recognizes this. He's a man who 100% supports his masters. I mean, if you think about the insanity of what, you know, what he's doing now, presenting the United States with a list of targets that he wants the United States to approve so that he can strike Russia is part of a larger plan for victory that includes Kursk, includes the invasion of Russia by Ukraine. And it requires the United States to dramatically change. I mean, this man lives in fantasy land. This man is insane, and his insanity is going to sadly result in the destruction of Ukraine. There are many Russians right now who have said that the goal of Russia now is to fix the error of, you know, Lenin. And you say, well, what error is that? Well, again, refer to Putin's speeches in the past where he said that Ukraine exists only because Lenin made a mistake in creating it. And so now the way to fix the Ukraine problem is to fix that mistake. The implication is that there will be no Ukraine when this conflict is over. And I think that that's a more likely outcome than anything Zelensky's getting ready to, you know, put on the table.
We have two options in the United States right now. One would be the Kamala Harris Democratic Party, that we know what would be their policy in Ukraine. It would be the same kind of policy as the Biden administration. But when it comes to the Trump and his mindset, recently J.D. Vance had an interview with Bill O'Reilly. He said that Europeans should focus on Ukraine, but while the United States' priority is China. Do they really think that Europe alone can help Ukraine continue in this conflict with Russia while they're focusing on China and maybe new sort of escalations between the United States and China?
I don't know. What I do know is this, that if Harris wins, she is going to have to put together a completely new foreign policy and national security team. Tony Blinken will not be part of this. Anthony Sullivan will not be part of this. Jake Sullivan, nobody will be. They're bringing in completely new thinkers. And why is this important? Because when she's sworn in, these people are going to be dealing. Understand that the reality that we see today during this campaign season, where you have candidates responding to breaking news, is not the reality that will be in existence in January when President Harris could be sworn in. It'll be a completely different reality that her new people are going to have to deal with. You know, it's one thing to sit here and articulate, you know, crowd-pleasing rhetoric, you know, back Ukraine, stand up to Russia. It's, you know, it's another thing to be sitting at the White House with Europe saying, we're done. Germany saying, we're broke. We can't do anymore. France going through a political crisis. Who knows if Macron will even be the president then. England collapsing under a wave of new taxes and the social unrest. Europe is literally disintegrating before our eyes, the immigration crisis, et cetera. And so all of these expectations about, you know, what Europe can and can't do, come January, it's going to complete. Ukraine is going to be complete. You know, Russia is taking out energy infrastructure right now. Ukraine will not come out of this winter alive. It'll be the end of the Ukrainian state. So all this bold rhetoric is meaningless, because there's a new reality that they're going to have to deal with in January. And that reality is going to include a strengthened and emboldened Russia. So I, 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 I just disregard anything that is said by either the Harris or the Trump camps. J.D. Vance is going to be a vice president who is as irrelevant as you know, this bottle cap. Donald Trump doesn't listen, doesn't take advice. J.D. Vance isn't going to be able to knock on the door and say, hey, boss, first of all, J.D. Vance is dumber than dirt about foreign policy. He may have some basic instincts to do this or do that. He knows nothing about Ukraine. It's obvious in everything he says about Ukraine. He knows nothing about Europe. There's nothing in his background that lends itself to this man being a foreign policy or national security genius. He just has some gut instincts. You know, America doesn't get involved in other people's war. Okay, I get that. But he's also a guy, you know, that does the Trump thing, you know, flexes his muscles and all that. Whatever J.D. Vance knows or doesn't know, says or doesn't say, as I said, come January, it's going to be irrelevant because there's a new reality in town. And Donald Trump's going to have to deal with that reality. And we don't know how he's going to deal with it because we can't paint that. But I think right now in this political season, this silly season, you know, What I'm looking more for is not the specifics of how they're going to stand up to Russia. What I'd like to hear is how they're going to keep America out of a war. That's what I want to hear from a leader. How are they going to prevent a nuclear war with Russia, with China? How are they going to bring about an end to this conflict? It's not about Ukraine winning. The conflict will end with Ukraine's defeat. How do you manage that defeat so it mitigates against ongoing, negative consequences? How do we restore Europe? Are we going to need to open up the spigots of cheap Russian gas to come back to Europe to allow Europe to rejuvenate because expensive American LNG isn't the option? Can the United States, how do we handle what could be the collapse of NATO, the collapse of the European Union? What is our plan? How do we do this in a way that we don't lose Europe in the process? These are the discussions that need to be had instead of talking about how some America is going to somehow retain its role as a global militaristic leader who is going to flex its muscles and people are going to poop their pants. That's fantasy. That's never going to happen again.
Do we see unity in the European Union right now? Because even in the Western part of Europe, you see the Czech president saying that the Nord Stream pipeline was a legitimate target. And right after that, the German government said, no, that wasn't the case. That wasn't, you cannot say that. How do you see the difference between Olaf Scholz and Macron? The differences between the Western part and the Eastern part of Europe. How do you see, without the pressure coming from the United States, is Europe willing to continue this conflict in Ukraine or not?
It doesn't matter if they're willing to. They don't have the ability to. So the question's already been answered. I mean, Germany, you know, you got your great German generals, a concept that doesn't exist today. But, you know, these bold leaders who have led massive armies into great success around the world. No, they haven't. Talking about, we need to retool and reconfigure to be ready to fight Russia in 5 years. Okay, with what? You just tried to pass a defense budget. You didn't get what you want. You only got, I think 1.2 billion euro increase in the budget, which doesn't match inflation, which means you're shrinking as you're talking about getting bigger. This is the reality. The Germans can't deliver on what they say they want to deliver on. The French are a freaking joke right now, literally just a disaster. Macron faces impeachment, or the other outcome is he'll be compelled to resign. France is falling apart on itself. There used to be a debate within the European Union that sort of broke down into what we call the Berlin School and the Parisian School. This is economic theory. I'm not an economist. But the Germans have, traditional banker, conservative, monetary policies. And the German mark is the heart of the euro. I mean, it's the German economy and the strength of the mark that made the transition to the euro possible. you know, the French franc less so, but it's still a big economy. But the French have an important political role to play, and they have much more liberal approach. And you saw that as you took a look at how Europe wanted to deal with, for instance, the crisis in Greece, the issues in Poland and southern Italy, etc. There was this debate taking place, you know, fiscal conservatism, fiscal liberalism. This is before Ukraine. This is, you know, Europe already fracturing into two schools of thought because the euro was running into the reality that the concept of a European Union, a European singularity, is an absurdity. It just doesn't work, especially when you start throwing in, you know, political hot potatoes like immigration, you know, that. So Europe is already deeply fractured, not just between Berlin and France, but between old Europe and new Europe, the newly empowered eastern part of Europe that after the Cold War, you know, became sort of the darlings of the West as we expanded NATO in an effort to create a bulwark against Russia to bring Russia down. But now that's running into, you know, and now they're inconvenient. Do you really think that the Latvians, Lithuanians, and Estonians are the most popular people in Europe today? These little chihuahuas running around barking, war, 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 war. And Europe's going, no, we don't want it. We don't have the means to do this. Poland, you know, is you know, the proverbial skinny kid at the beach who got that matchbox, the old Charles Atlas, you know, lift weights and you can be. So he went to the gym and he got a little bit of flex here, and he's out there on the beach flexing and thinking he's bigger than he is. Poland's just a pathetically small Central European country that has no meaning, no relevance by itself. There's a reason why Poland gets invaded and people cross over, because Poland sucks as a nation. And it will continue. I'm sorry, Poles, but prove me wrong. Elect a government that stands for something other than letting the rest of the world back you up while you flex. You pulled that a couple of times, and that's why you got occupied. That's why you got defeated. Okay? You wanted the world to come to your rescue in World War II. Not going to happen. Nobody's coming to your rescue because nobody cares about you. You're irrelevant. You're like Ukraine. You know, you just don't matter. You could matter if you brought something positive to the mix, contributed in a meaningful fashion. But the moment you start thinking that you're bigger than you are, when you're something you're not, then it becomes problematic. And so the Poles will continue to be a huge problem for Europe. You have, you know, Hungary threatening. I mean, who knows where Hungary is going to go? Bulgaria, Romania is going through some problems. Europe is not a stable environment. It's an inherently destabilized entity that's collapsing in on itself as it speaks. You know, that's the reality. So we should stop this nonsense about speaking about, you know, Europe and what Europe's going to do. Europe is going to disappear. Europe doesn't exist. Nation states exist. And each one of these nation states, as Europe collapses, is going to collapse in on itself and try and solve the problem for itself. Do you really think the French political crisis is going to be solved by somebody in Brussels saying, well, we in the European Union believe that France should do the following? France can say pound sand. Italy is going to have some big problems coming up. You know, we haven't heard from them in a while, but trust me, those problems are there. The Meloni government may not be long on this planet. None of these governments are long on this planet because the economic crises that face Europe collectively, not just individual states, but collectively, are almost insurmountable. And at the end of the day, when you're a politician, I think James Carville's 1992 you know, maxim to Bill Clinton, it's the economy, stupid. It's the economy. It's not Ukraine and Russia and war. It's the economy. Do the people have jobs? Do the people have health insurance? Do the people, you know, have a standard of living? And remember, we're not talking about taking people out of the depression and making them better where they've already suffered and they're strong and resilient. We're about taking the softest people in the planet, the spoiled European populations that had, you know, big vacations, big pensions, guaranteed everything. Why? Because they could underwrite it with cheap Russian gas. And now they're collapsing. And so their expectations are to stay up here. It's not to start from nothing and go upwards. It's to prevent itself from going downwards. And a politician right now isn't going to be able to deliver on that. So one by one by one by one, you're going to watch successive European governments fail because they can't live up to the expectations of the people they're supposed to serve, not the European Union, not the European singularity, but the French people, the German people, the Italian people. Europe forgot how to do that because they bought into this nonsense of the European Union, the stupidity of a singularity when one never existed and one will never exist. And that's the reality of Europe. It's again, what I'll say today is that the European problem that manifests itself right now, that people are talking about, is going to be a very different problem come January when the next president's sworn in, and a very different problem come next summer. We're talking about rapid, the rapid collapse of this European Union, this European promise.
Do you see any sign that Europe is learning from the conflict in Ukraine if something happens between the United States and China, not to get involved in that sort of conflict because they have been damaged by this conflict? They have been hurting by this conflict in Ukraine too much that they cannot sustain any sort of new conflict with China because we know how important China is for Europe.
I don't think, look, when you're, of course, everybody knows China's important for Europe. Germany sent successive delegations to China. And again, to show you the stupidity of this whole European concept and their subordination to the United States, we have told Europe that you have to break away from your dependence upon the Chinese, supply chain and things of that nature. And the Chinese went, so you're sanctioning us, you're breaking from us, you're breaking with it. No, we're, and I forget the term, we're de-risking. Instead of de-linking, we're de-risking. What that means is reducing the risks that are entailed by too much dependence upon Chinese economic change. But Scholz went over there with the head of, I think, VW and maybe some other German automobile makers, and Scholz and his people, Baerbock and others are like, we're going to de-risk. And the Chinese are like, all right, if you insist, if you want to. And VW turns around and goes, boss, what the hell are you talking about de-risking? Well, we want to strengthen opportunities. He said, you understand that VW as an entity is losing money everywhere in the world. We don't make money anywhere in the world because of your stupid policies, because of the lunacy of what you've done with energy prices, et cetera. The only place that we make money is China. That's it. And now you want to de-risk? You want me to pull out? If I pull out, VW collapses. And if VW collapses, Germany collapses. And Olaf Scholz went, oh, I guess we can't de-risk. This is the reality. The Europeans need China. They can't function without China because the economic interaction with China is oftentimes the only profitable economic activity taking place in Europe. It's not profitable with America. America, your friend, is gouging you with high gas prices. We don't care. We claim to care, but we don't care. Our guys are making money hand over fist. The stakeholders, the shareholders are like, hey, great, we're making lots of money. Nobody cares about Europe. Again, I come back to America's a friend of nobody. America's a friend only to itself. And even then, we're not necessarily, friendly to ourselves because if you're Republican, you hate a Democrat, Democrat, you hate a Republican, et cetera. But of course, we're oversimplifying this problem, but I'm talking about trends. The trend is Europe can't live without China. China can definitely live without Europe. That's why people have to understand the importance of what's happening with BRICS. If BRICS ever solidifies as a G7 equivalent in the global South, what you have is a self-sustaining economic universe that Europe and America don't play a part of. And therefore we've become irrelevant. And then we get to trade with one another, but not, there's so much economic potential in the Eurasian landmass. If India and China and Russia ever fully start cooperating, that right there is game, set, match. And if BRICS happens in Kazan, the big three will be sitting at the same table. Vladimir Putin, Modi, Xi Jinping. Boom! They own the world. They're the controllers. There's the masters of the universe. Well, they're not the master of America. America doesn't matter anymore. America doesn't matter. We've made ourselves irrelevant. We can't afford. I mean, we just sent, you know, all these aircraft carriers and ships off to the Persian Gulf to, you know, influence the region. We can't afford that, by the way. It wasn't budgeted. So we have to steal money from the rest of the military to pay for that. You know, that's all right. That's what we'll do. But meanwhile, we're decommissioning 17 ships in the Navy because we can't find sailors to man them. Nobody's joining. Nobody's joining the Army. We already had to shrink the Army. Marine Corps is doing okay because, you know, the few, the proud, and the propaganda machine works and people go to the Marine Corps. But, you know, the Air Force is shrinking. Everything's shrinking. Why? Nobody wants to be part of this military machine anymore. People are looking around the world saying, no, it's forever war overseas doing other people's business. We want to be home making money, you know, living the good life, living the dream. You know, and that's the reality, is that we are positioning ourselves for, you know, potential conflict around the world, but we're going to need others to be our proxies. Australia. I mean, the Australians are really the dumbest people on the planet. Why would you enter into a relationship with the United States that allowed your nation to be turned into an American aircraft carrier, which all that means is that China's going to sink you with nuclear weapons if there's ever a war? Why would you do that? You know, allow the United States, you know, we now have 2,400 Marines there. We're talking about permanently stationed 16,000 Marines. We're talking about bringing in brigades of U.S. Army to do what? A resumption of the island campaign of World War II to drive the Chinese out of the South Pacific, out of the South China Sea. Why would the Philippines embark on this operation with America? Because let me tell you what happens when America, when a push comes to shove. America will not be there for you. We're going to get you into a bind, whether your name is Australia or the Philippines, and then we're going to run. We're going to fall back, and you're going to be left holding the bag, paying the price. Checks on the table, we're gone with our credit card, and you got to pay the price. This is what's going to happen. Instead of relying upon diplomacy and talking and working things out in an equitable fashion, the United States only knows one thing, military intervention, military intervention. We only have one tool. Weapons. So we flood weapons to Australia, we flood weapons to Philippines, and then it leads to a conflict that we can't sustain. There's all this talk about Taiwan. Let's just be clear. The United States cannot fight a war in Taiwan. Cannot do it. There. Said it. Which means that if we are going to engage with the Chinese decisively over Taiwan, we either accept the inevitability of a humiliating defeat or we go nuclear. And now there will probably be something that you, I don't know if you're going to bring it up, but you see, we've provoked the Chinese because what we've said is if it goes nuclear, of course, we got, you know, 1,400 some odd nuclear weapons deployed. We're ready to use them at any time. We have a range of options. Our nuclear employment plan gives us the ability to go low, high, heavy. We could even preempt China right now and take out their 400 nukes, and that's not a problem. The Chinese went, oh, yeah, you're right. So we're going to build 360 missile silos, and we're not going to put all of the DF-41s in there, but let's say we put 100 in there. So you don't know which ones they're in. They're all over China, but each DF-41 is going to have 10 nuclear warheads capable of delivered 10,000 miles to anywhere in the United States. We build 100 of these missiles. That's 1,000 warheads, dingbat. Now you want to play nuclear war with us? You want to do that, America? And Biden just woke up. Signed a new nuclear employment plan that has to factor this in, which doesn't make the world safer. It makes the world more dangerous. Where's arms control of all this? Nobody's talking about arms control. So we are in an arms race with China right now. The last nuclear treaty with Russia expires in February 26, and then we will enter into a new arms race there. Ladies and gentlemen, save up your money and go on vacation this summer. Maybe you might get one in next summer, but that's it. Then you're going to die. That's the direction we're headed. This is the reality. A nuclear arms race in a world where the American empire is not the force of stability, but rather the force of instability, that as we collapse, we create more and more crises because we are the military-industrial complex. The only way our economy continues to thrive is by making sure defense industry being fed contract after contract, but those contracts require conflict. And so we promote conflict, conflict, contract, contract, money, money, nuclear war, we all die. That's where we're headed right now.
New York Times reported that Jake Sullivan going to be in China trying to convince. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
New York Times reported that Jake Sullivan going to be in China trying to convince Chinese again not to help Russia. And do you think that he's going to put a new kind of pressure on Chinese? I don't know what he's going to do, but so far we haven't seen that China going to agree with the United States on putting pressure on not helping Russia. Why is he thinking that this time he's able to change the mind of Chinese?
Well, let's just think about this logically. It's September, or it's almost September. The election will be in November. A new president will be sworn in January. No matter who wins the election, Jake Sullivan's out of government. Do you think the Chinese give a rat's ass about anything Jake Sullivan's about to say? You think the Chinese are going, ooh, let's lean in hard here. Jake Sullivan's coming. I mean, my God, we're going to have to deal with this guy for another 4 years. No, he's done. Literally the definition of a lame duck. I think right now he has to go through the motions because the world is expecting this. You know, the United States has to be seen as doing something, promoting something. But China's not going to, you know, change its policies. What does the United States have to offer China? China is with BRICS. That's the direction, multipolarity. I mean, is the United States going to say, hey, if you dump Russia, we'll join BRICS? No. You know, hey, if you dump Russia, we'll dissolve the G7. No. Hey, if you dump BRICS or dump Russia, we'll give up on Taiwan. China might listen to that one, but Sullivan's not going to put that on the table. I mean, this is stupidity. What is Jake Sullivan going to bring to the table? Not a damn thing. Let's go back to the start of the Biden administration, a meeting that took place between Sullivan, Blinken, and their Chinese counterparts, where the United States started off by trying to lecture the Chinese, and they were shut down immediately. And the Chinese said, this ain't your daddy's China-U.S. relationship. This is a new one. We are not inferior to you. In many ways, we are superior to you, and we will never again be lectured by you about anything. And that's the reality. So, what's Jake Sullivan going to do? Go over there with what? First of all, he's the national security advisor. Okay? He's not a policy maker. He's a policy implementer. So normally, if the national security advisor is going to take a lead, that means that there's been an interagency decision. But there's never an interagency decision made in a news vacuum, because everybody wants to pick up the phone and, be the person that was responsible for the headline story. So this is an act of desperation. This is a literal act of desperation by Jake Sullivan. It's going to go nowhere.
Just to wrap up this session, Scott, when we talk about BRICS, right now we know Azerbaijan and Palestine are asking to be part of BRICS. And how BRICS can help Palestine, in your opinion, if Azerbaijan finally gets into this organization, and how BRICS can put pressure on Azerbaijan? We know that Azerbaijan is so important in providing oil to Israel. And is that possible that through Azerbaijan, BRICS just put some sort of pressure on Israel? Is that possible? Or,
well, I think you missed the whole purpose of BRICS, because what you're describing is what the United States does and its allies. And BRICS has said, that's not us. We're a consensus organization. We don't put pressure on anybody. We come up with a decision that people buy into. We have discussions. But what BRICS is going to now sanction Azerbaijan? Hey, join our organization so we can sanction you. No, that's not how it works. What happens is Azerbaijan comes in and people say, hey, Gaza's a problem. Everybody goes, yep, Gaza's a problem. We need to come up with a solution. Yep. How do we work together to get this solution done? You know, and then they work out of that. But we really need to stop thinking like America thinks. BRICS will not be a sanctioning body. They're not going to sanction. BRICS will be a body that promises growth, not war. You know, promises, you know, cohesion and unity, not, you know, separation and isolation. What can Palestine expect from this? One, if they're part of BRICS in one way or another, the economic potential of BRICS to help rebuild Palestine. I think that's a very big thing. And you know, that's where China comes into play. That's where all of the BRICS nations comes into play. But the idea that that Azerbaijan's being lured into BRICS so that Russia and China can put pressure on it, that's American thinking. That's not how BRICS operates. BRICS is a consensus-driven organization that will not, it's just not going to, that's how America defeated itself. I mean, my God, if we hadn't sanctioned the world, we'd still be the most influential economic power in the world today, where people actually look to us and say, oh, you know, a relationship with America is economically beneficial. Now people are fearful. We have an economic relation with America, but we don't have independent foreign policy anymore, because if we ever do something we think is good for us, America will sanction us. And so therefore, it's not good to be closely tied to America. It's not good to be dependent upon the dollar. This is why there's a drive for de-dollarization, alternative forms of international payment. The United States has destroyed itself through this tool of sanctioning. Why would BRICS ever follow that pattern of behavior?
Yeah. Thank you so much, Scott, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
Well, thanks for having me.